Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The popular tale of the Mutiny on the Bounty, describing what has by now become a legendary struggle between a tyrannical captain and his mutinous crew, has been told many times, popularized most often in prose, poetry, and film. So what more is there to say? Plenty, it seems, when one looks at the facts of the case or its actual history. And our guest this week, Caroline Alexander, has done just that in her latest book, The Bounty, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Bounty. And after my conversation with Caroline Alexander, Thomas Alan Schwartz will be joining us to talk about how President Lyndon Johnson handled a direct challenge to American military presence in and partnership with Europe in the mid-1960s. But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on January 15, 1929, civil rights leader Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was born in Atlanta, Georgia. After attending local schools and skipping the 9th and 10th grade, King entered Morehouse College at the age of 15. He followed in his father's and grandfather's footsteps in the Baptist ministry and was ordained at the age of 19. He became assistant pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, but chose to continue his studies, earning his bachelor's in divinity from Crozier Theological Seminary in 1951 and his doctorate from Boston University 4 years later. King became pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, where he led the now-famous bus boycott initiated by Rosa Parks' refusal to give up her seat to a white passenger. In 1959, King resigned from the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church to lead the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He developed a reputation for facing violent opposition with calm and for seeking change through nonviolence, sit-ins, marches, and peaceful demonstrations, all of which inspired love and hate across the nation. He was an eloquent speaker, perhaps best remembered for his famous "I Have a Dream" speech given to a crowd of over 250,000 at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. in 1963. The next year, King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. In April 1968, he went to Memphis, Tennessee, to lead a protest by sanitation workers against low wages and poor working conditions. On April 4th, as he stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, King was shot and killed by James Earl Ray.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the next presidential campaign has already begun, and a number of Democratic candidates have already tossed their hats into the ring. There are legislators, governors, and even a general. The legislators are trailing both the governor of a comparatively small state and the general of a small war. Some may find that surprising, but not Christopher DeMuth, head of the American Enterprise Institute, who has written an article on the subject for the January-February issue of American Enterprise. Governors and Generals Rule is the title. DeMuth sorted through the 88 majority party candidates in the 44 elections that have produced 31 elected presidents since 1828, the beginning of mass politics. He divided them into five categories: governors, military leaders, legislators, statesmen and activists, and vice presidents. He found that governors and generals account for 55% of elected presidents and 52% of presidential nominees. The pool of legislators is much larger, but only 3 of the 31 elected presidents came from legislative backgrounds. Why? Executives and generals make decisions, DeMuth ventures, and take responsibility for those decisions. Legislators make compromises and broker coalitions, which may be crucial to democratic governance, but they are of little consequence for them as individuals. Further, as a senator is 1% of, and a representative 1/435th of, one half of one branch of government, they're less accountable than governors or generals. And finally, governors who seek the presidency often do so on a platform to clean up the mess in Washington. Legislators are usually seen as part of that mess. This is Talking History. On the morning of April 28, 1789, Master's Mate Fletcher Christian led a mutiny against Lieutenant, better known to us as Captain William Bligh, placing Bligh and 18 officers and crew in a small boat and setting them adrift. The tale of the mutiny on the Bounty has been told many times in prose, poetry, and film. Three major films, to be exact. So what more is there to say? A great deal, it seems, and the story as told by our guest this week, Caroline Alexander, is a far different story from that which most of us know. Caroline Alexander is the author of The Bounty, the true story of the mutiny on the Bounty, published by Viking Press. She's also the author of four previous books, most recently The Endurance, Shackleton's legendary Antarctic expedition. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. What led you to investigate the history behind the mutiny on the Bounty?
Shackleton, the subject of my previous book, was what led me indirectly to the Bounty. People who know that story will know that at the heart of Shackleton's great journey of survival is an amazing open boat voyage. And in trying to put his voyage into some sort of historical perspective, I did reading of other voyages and found that the only one ever spoken of in the same sort of reverential breath was the voyage of William Bligh in the Bounty's launch after the mutiny on the Bounty. So that was the hook for me.
What was the date of the Shackleton, or approximately when did that occur?
Shackleton's expedition set out in 1914, and then he sort of stumbled back finally in 1916. And so Bligh's voyage predated his by about 120-something years.
Right. Okay. Any other modern historical accounts of the voyage, the Bounty I'm talking about now?
Not historical in its entirety, no, not at all. There's some very fine, two, I think, very good biographies of William Bligh published some decades ago, which are very sober, careful examinations of his life from beginning to end. And those biographers clearly had a handle on the entirety of who Bligh was and had him in perspective, as it were, and are very clear that they regard him as an honorable man and not a villain. But to find a coherent, sort of complete story of the mutiny on the Bounty in print, really, you almost have to go back to John Barrow's account, which was published in 1831 and is still sort of available in folio editions and so forth. There have been others. There was a biography about Fletcher Christian by a Christian family descendant, which has wonderful new material about Christian, but is, I think, otherwise very, we'll say, unduly pro-Christian. But this complete story, believe it or not, in a kind of authoritative historical examination of this legend really didn't exist. That the classic that everybody would, you know, reach to put their hand to was a work were the works of fiction by Nordhoff and Hall, the famous trilogy of the Mutiny on the Bounty.
Okay, and you more or less start off from the perspective that the story told there in that classic, if you will, is all wrong. That's
well, I didn't start off with it. What I did start off with was an interest, and again, I'm going to sort of revert to Shackleton for a moment. What fascinated me about that voyage was obviously the personality of Sir Ernest Shackleton, but I was also, I think, equally interested in the men he led. And that led me to do quite extensive investigation into finding out different family members, and I got new material that way. And I sort of brought the same kind of approach to the Bounty, which was that there were more than two men on the Bounty. It wasn't just William Bligh and Fletcher Christian. And I think that that approach, this sort of power of darkness and the Prince Galahad figure of Fletcher Christian, has not just sort of, well, it's made a fabulous story, let's be very honest.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great romantic tale. But I think it has somewhat warped actual research, not just presentation, but I felt even the way people approach the material. For example, to look at Bligh's log, which is a wonderful source material, not just as a key to clues where Fletcher Christian's name might crop up or signs of imminent trouble, but to just take it as you would any other log of another voyage and just look at it and see the journey unfolding, and also very, very revealing of Bligh's own character as a man, not just as the person who's going to be mutinied about. And so I felt that there was a way that if one was prepared to look at this as a totality, as a fresh story, as an event without bouncing off anybody else's approach, one was going to be able to make fresher use of old material.
Okay. Tell us the story. Refresh our memory. What happened that morning of April 28th, 1789?
Well, Bligh is commander of the Bounty. He's Lieutenant Bligh, given the honorary title, as it were, for the purpose of this ship of captain of the Bounty, which is now somewhere in the wide Pacific. They're about 3 weeks out from Tahiti on the homeward voyage, having successfully accomplished this task of getting, a centric task of getting breadfruit plants, which Bligh is now going to try and take over to the West Indies. Critical to the story is the fact that the next important landmark on this voyage was going to be the navigation of what was then called the Endeavour Strait. This is now the Torres Strait, the very dangerous divide between Northern Australia and New Guinea. This is where the only British naval ship to have attempted this was Captain Cook, who ran aground on the Great Barrier Reef. It is today notoriously difficult to navigate, even with Torres Strait pilots and beacons and everything else. And one thing that's generally not regarded about this voyage is that I think the Admiralty were very indifferent to the breadfruit venture, which they'd sort of been shanghaied into doing by merchant interest, but they were interested in the navigation of the Endeavour Strait. And transcripts that come up from what various mutineers said in their court-martial and other men who were later interviewed indicate that everybody was braced to have to work very hard in going through the Endeavour Strait. And Christian was reported to have said, in approaching the Endeavour Strait, I'm sure the ship will be a hell. So that's on his mind when he goes into the cabin and yanks Bligh out of sleep, brings him up on board and says, you are no longer in command of this ship.
Okay. And they cast off Bligh and some of the crew in a small boat, and what happens to Bligh?
In a very small boat. And more men than they had planned join Bligh. So at the end of the day, you have a small boat, 23 feet long, with 19 men in it, and consigned to certain death. And Bligh seems to have lost no time in deciding that he was going to get back to England. And this is, again, remarkably documented in his log. So with food that should have lasted them about 5 days, they embarked on what would be a 48-day ordeal with no charts and very crude navigation equipment. And Bligh brought his company, his men, save one who was murdered by islanders on one island landfall, to the safety in the Dutch East Indies.
So he was good at what he did.
He was very good at what he did, and this is why this voyage is regarded with such veneration by sort of sailors.
Sure. What about the mutinous crew? What happened to them?
Well, they sort of fared well for a while, but then they also came unstuck. Their intention was to head to Tahiti, and then somewhere I think they suddenly realized that that might not be the wisest thing to do, given that that was one of the few islands in the Pacific that the British Navy knew about and could be counted on to finally return to look for them. So they tried to make a settlement on the island of Tubuai. That didn't work. They were at each other's throat. Christian starts becoming, in a way, quite despotic, according to some reports, always carrying a pistol with him and threatening to flog men when they didn't comply with his orders. This all comes from a manuscript source from one of the men later charged with mutiny. And then finally they decide, okay, we can't hang together as a group. So some return to Tahiti to wait their fate, and 8 men go with Christian and the Bounty off to roam the seas looking for an uninhabited island, which they found in a remote island called Pitcairn, where they finally sort of decided to make a home, came on shore, and then burnt the Bounty and therefore burnt their bridges.
Does everyone get back home eventually?
Very few get back. Well, bits and pieces get back home. Bligh gets back home, makes a report to the Admiralty. The Admiralty comes out to make sure that as many mutineers as they can bring back home do come home. And indeed, 10 mutineers eventually are captured and brought, arrive in chains in Britain, and they are the ones who stand court-martial for Christian's crime, as it were. And then the big mystery is what happens to Fletcher Christian. And there are various reports, a number of reports that he died on Pitcairn Island, although he always seems to die in a different way, which is suspect. And then there are many sort of Elvis sightings of Christian in England. So whether he got home or not is I guess, an enigma.
Okay. Tell us about the trial.
Well, the trial is, to me, where the dynamics of the story, really, the story we know as the Mutiny on the Bounty, is created. You have a situation where 10 men are now facing death if they're found guilty of mutiny. One of these men, the only officer, a young midshipman called Peter Haywood, happens to be connected to, as I discovered, Lord Howe, who was the highest naval figure in the land. So to save him, his various family connections rally around, and the result is, at the end of the day, that 4 men are exonerated on Bligh's word as being held against their will by the mutineers. 3 men are hanged, but Peter Haywood and his companions are pardoned and therefore set free. And it's the dynamics of the court-martial and the special interests pulled there and the way the story is manipulated that most interested me, and I think I found the most new material on.
So the story comes out quite differently from the court-martial than you understand it historically.
Yes. What you see going into the court-martial is a straightforward account of Bligh as the sort of hero of his own little saga, an officer doing his job who was overpowered by pirates and who somehow heroically managed to get back to England to make a report to king and country. That's the story going into the trial. Coming out of the trial, once Peter Haywood, this young officer, is safe and knows he's not going to hang, you start seeing the story being recreated, both by his family and by Fletcher Christian's family. And what they decided to do, clearly, and I think may have almost been acting on instinct, almost believing it, is to declare, which had never been suggested before in British naval history, that there was a justification for mutiny, a reason for it. And the reason was tyranny and oppression. And this, of course, is all being spun out at the height of the French Revolution. A lot of revolutionary sympathizers are still in England, and many of them, in fact, were friends of the Christians. It's also the beginning of the Romantic movement in literature. I think Fletcher Christian's cause was greatly helped by the fact that his school friend and schoolfellow was William Wordsworth, and the Wordsworth and the Christians were very, very close. And what you have is suddenly a romantic hero. I think Fletcher Christian was the first romantic hero. A romantic hero who spurns oppression and tyranny and somehow has declared himself for the rights of man, as it were, and sailed off into the South Seas, sort of wandering like the ancient mariner across the ocean looking for a place to expiate his rather glamorous sin. So that is the story that has really come down to us, and it depended upon motivating the mutiny in a way that I think it was almost motiveless, and that meant making Bligh the villain.
Interesting. So the story resonates. It's really fit well into the context of the times. What if the story had not been changed? What if it had come down pretty much as happened? Would the story have just died in terms of its popularity at the time?
I think so. I think it would have been a footnote in history, and I think we would have learned about it. I don't think it would have vanished, because I think Bligh's open boat voyage would have secured its historical place, and at least people interested in the sea would sort of come back to that. But my guess is that if the spin hadn't happened, the story would have ended with the triumphant return of William Bligh. In other words, there would have been a mutiny at sea, and the heroic captain would have brought his men home, and that would be the climax, the return of Bligh to the Admiralty.
Interesting. Where did you get your information for this?
In many places. Some of it was well-trodden material that just needed to be sort of re-looked at, but much was fresh. I found a great deal on the Isle of Man that related to Peter Haywood and his family background that was highly illuminating. Letters from Lord Howe that were found at the Huntington Library, which had never been seen in the context of this story. And then I was had a lot of luck with wills. Wills tell you a great deal about who really counts in a person's life, in terms of who they name as executor or legatee. And that revealed to me some very, very interesting and totally unexpected connections between some of the players.
Well, I like the romanticized version, but that really set up your book perfectly to be able to challenge that, and you did a good job with it. You got another book in the works?
I haven't quite emerged from the 18th century yet, so I need to decompress first.
Okay, great. Well, good luck and congratulations on your new book, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest this week has been Caroline Alexander, author of The Bounty, The True Story of the Mutiny on the Bounty, published by Viking Press. And this is Talking History. It all sounds familiar. An American president from Texas is dismissed as a reckless cowboy, an ignorant provincial by Europeans. The French, in particular, are up in arms. No, we're not speaking of George W. Bush, but rather Lyndon Johnson. Thomas Allen Schwartz, professor of history at Vanderbilt University, looks back at this interesting historical parallel dating to the mid-1960s.
The headlines proclaimed, NATO crisis worsens, an Atlantic alliance in disarray. The French government bitterly criticized American policy, refusing to support a military buildup. German newspapers lampooned the American defense secretary for his harsh language about their responsibility as allies. Many Americans called for the withdrawal of their troops from Europe. Public protests attacked the president from Texas for his cowboy style of diplomacy. Sound familiar? Although these issues closely resemble the recent news, they actually describe the NATO crisis of 1966, when President Lyndon Baines Johnson faced off against the imperious French leader Charles de Gaulle. In my new book, Lyndon Johnson and Europe, In the Shadow of Vietnam, I describe how de Gaulle was determined to challenge American leadership. When in March 1966 he announced that he wanted both NATO and American forces out of France, as he would soon travel to Moscow to negotiate with the Russian leaders. Denouncing the American war in Vietnam, de Gaulle styled himself the champion of a Europe that would stretch from the Atlantic to the Urals. Lyndon Johnson, in de Gaulle's view, was a vulgar and boorish Texan, and it was absolutely intolerable that Europe was dependent on the United States. Historians rarely credit Lyndon Johnson with any skills in the conduct of foreign policy. To most scholars, Johnson was the classic ugly American, a quintessential provincial who was ill-equipped to deal with foreign policy. Johnson sometimes played to the image of a country hick, once telling reporters, "Boys, I don't understand foreigners. They're different from us." Most historians credit Johnson with his great successes in domestic legislation like civil rights, yet they always balance this against Vietnam and the overall failure of his foreign policy. Johnson's handling of the alliance crisis of 1966, however, calls for a different verdict. Johnson could have exploited de Gaulle's defiance, rallying Americans to support him by denouncing the ungrateful French. Americans were angry. One political cartoon showed de Gaulle standing among the white crosses at the cemetery in Normandy, proclaiming, "Why do you Americans stay where you're not wanted?" But Johnson scrupulously observed the dictum he had given to Secretary of Defense McNamara. When a man asks you to leave his house, you don't argue, you get your hat and go. The president quickly withdrew U.S. forces from France, and he reined in his anti-de Gaulle advisers, many of them sophisticated diplomats who were convinced that the United States should punish France by withdrawing its military protection. LBJ may have seemed provincial, but he understood geography better than they did. As long as the United States was defending West Germany, it would also be defending France, no matter what the French did or said to provoke Washington. Johnson's restraint paid off. Johnson worked carefully with the British and French to reconstitute the foundations of the NATO alliance, gradually isolating France. When the Soviet Union invaded a liberalizing Czechoslovakia and destroyed any hope for de Gaulle's vision of Europe, U.S. and French leaders resumed their cooperation. The NATO alliance's strength and cohesion over the next two decades helped bring about the collapse of the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe. Vietnam still cast its shadow over Johnson's accomplishments, but the war never caused him to lose sight of the central lesson of the post-World War II world. European and American cooperation has been vital to international peace, freedom, and stability.
You've been listening to Thomas Allen Schwartz, professor of history at Vanderbilt University and the author of Lyndon Johnson and Europe, In the Shadow of Vietnam, published by Harvard University Press. And finally, we leave you with a hoax. Several weeks ago, we interviewed Alex Berza, the author of The Museum of Hoaxes, a collection of pranks, stunts, deceptions, and other wonderful stories contrived for the public from the Middle Ages to the new millennium. That interview proved so popular, we've invited him to call in a few more hoaxes and contrived stories. This week, he presents Princess Caribou.
On April 3, 1817, a mysterious, exotic-looking woman walked through the door of a tavern in Almondsbury, England. She must have turned heads because she was extremely attractive, and she wore a black shawl twisted turban style around her head. But who was she? Nobody knew. And when the owner of the tavern asked her to identify herself, he discovered that she didn't speak English, nor any language that he had ever heard before. Not knowing what to do with her and sensing that she was lost and confused, he sent her off to the home of a local magistrate. Over the next few weeks, the magistrate and his wife slowly unraveled her story. They discovered that she was a princess from the faraway land of Javasu, who had been kidnapped by pirates but escaped her captors by jumping overboard in the English Channel. Soon word of Princess Caribou, as she was dubbed, had spread throughout England. Luxuries were showered down on her. Scholars traveled from London to study her language. Royalty expressed their interest in meeting her. It was a good life for Princess Caribou, and it might have remained good if a local woman hadn't read a description of the princess in the paper and immediately recognized her as Mary Baker, the daughter of a Devonshire cobbler who had worked briefly as her servant. When confronted with the accusation, Mary tearfully confessed. She explained that she had been begging for money on the road when she discovered that by wrapping a shawl around her head and pretending to be foreign, people were more willing to give her money. One thing led to another, and soon she had created the character of Princess Caribou. Of course, her deception was aided by the fact that this was the age of romanticism, and many people were more than willing to believe the romantic notion that an exotic princess was wandering the countryside, waiting to be rescued. Mary Baker had committed a crime, but she was so charming that no one had it in their heart to punish her. Instead, they paid for her passage to America, where she was received as a celebrity. But after 7 years, she tired of the coarse manners of the Yankees and returned to England, where, it is said, she made a living selling leeches to hospitals, though occasionally she would wrap the shawl around her head again and go down to the main street in Bristol, where, for a fee, she would pose before adoring crowds as Princess Caribou.
You've been listening to Alex Berza, author of The Museum of Hoaxes, published by Dutton Press, and the curator of a virtual museum of the same title, which you can access at www.museumofhoaxes.com. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.